for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
Catapults of propaganda.
The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
Funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to this wonderful Resurrection Weekend. Derek and I are recording our interview tonight on Thursday, March the 20th. It is going to be put on the internet this weekend during the Easter weekend. And, boy, there's a lot to talk about. We have an amazing guest, but we also have some sad news.
We do. You may have heard or possibly have not heard that Michael Corbin, who was the longtime host of the radio program For a Closer Look, a very influential and instrumental researcher and broadcaster, passed away Tuesday afternoon. Basically, what we know is that he was declared dead sometime before 3 o'clock local time at a hospital in Denver, Colorado on Tuesday. Apparently the victim of a massive stroke.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, our guest tonight, a man that I know each of you has been very familiar with, who writes often at WorldNet Daily, Dr. Jerome Corsi. Dr. Corsi, you, how many times were you interviewed by Michael?
Oh, many. He was a great guy. I'm really saddened to hear of his loss. And I wish, you know, his family well, and I don't know much about him personally, but he interviewed me many times. I was always did a great interview. He was always very knowledgeable, and that was terrific to be interviewed by him. I thought he was a great guy. I really miss him.
Yeah, it's a huge loss for all of us.
I spent many days while I was supposed to be working.
You don't want to say that too loud. You don't work there anymore, but your current boss may not appreciate that.
No, but the show was streamed live on the internet, and there were many days when I would have Michael's show streaming over my desktop computer. And in fact, Jerry, that's where I first really became aware of you. I think most observers of the political scene in America know of you from just the phrase "swift boat," which has become a verb in the American lexicon. But the interviews that Michael did with you, you're absolutely right. From a listener's standpoint, you know, before I got back into radio for that brief period in Missouri, were extremely educational when they weren't just flat out eye popping. In my opinion, Michael Corbin was probably the best interviewer and talk show host in America. But picking up and moving forward, there's an awful lot that's happened since we last talked just 5 weeks ago. Interestingly, I went back and I listened to the interview that we did again afterward because, to be honest with you, I didn't feel like I was all there when we talked last time, Jerry. I was really struggling and trying to keep focused, and it sounded like I knew more about what I was saying than I actually did at the time.
You did fine.
You were sleep interviewing.
Yeah, it was something like that. But there were some things that you brought out in that interview that in the last 5 weeks have really come to pass. I mean, essentially, you were saying that we were on the verge of what looked like an economic meltdown. And here we are. You've twice this week written about the Dow Jones taking drops of 200 to 300 points or more.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on out there in the American economy?
Well, it is a meltdown. I mean, it's a crisis of assets at this point. It started with the mortgage bubble bursting. You know, the Greenspan kept rates so low in 2003 and 2004, 1%, artificially low, that it encouraged people to, first of all, it propped up the values of houses all across the country. I mean, everybody suddenly thinks that they were in a house that was worth twice as much as they paid for it, and everybody's counting these great equity values, and of course also then borrowing home equity loans, which was a very bad idea. Taking money out of using their home like an ATM. And when rates started raising and Bernanke really started raising the rates, the mortgage bubble burst. And with housing prices going up in various areas, I mean, you know, housing prices going down, actually, when the bubble burst, because the people not able to make their payments, higher interest rates, a lot of people were not qualified to begin with. They said, well, you can sell the house in a year before this teaser rate goes up in the second year and adjusts. Well, the second year when the teaser rate adjusted, the house wasn't worth as much as they bought it for, so they couldn't sell it. But all, a whole series of tragedies like this occurred. And as a result, the housing market started melting down around the country. And the mortgages were going in foreclosure. The mortgages had been packaged together and sold to the banks and securities firms as collateralized mortgage obligations, which the banks were then putting into their asset portfolio, where the banks had traditionally held on to mortgages as assets. Now, there were mortgage banks or the savings and loans used to do this. Now the mortgage brokers were working with pools of capital, and the actual loans themselves of mortgages weren't owned by anybody except loan processors. They were packaged into these collateralized mortgage obligations and sold. As the mortgages started to foreclose, then the securities based on those mortgages went down in value. And so the banks started taking big losses in their asset portfolios. Now, some of these banks or some funds that were packaged around the banks, around these mortgage products, like Capital Group had a fund that was going to invest in mortgage-backed securities. And remember, these were highly rated. They were AAA, and they came from Fannie Mae or, you know, Freddie Mac mortgage pools. I mean, these were supposed to be very secure investments. The rating agencies all, you know, gave them a gold star on them.
Mm-hmm.
So they started failing. It was a great shock. And various banks and a lot of securities firms and many of these funds got to be leveraged. They went out and they borrowed against the assets that they had, maybe 25 to 1, and went back and bought more mortgage-backed securities with borrowed money. Now, that's fine as long as all the mortgage-backed securities continue to go up in value, as the homes go up in value. You know, you can buy as many of them as you want with borrowed money and pay off the borrowings. But when the securities themselves and the home mortgages begin to fail, then you know, you're holding an asset that may be close to worthless and not able to be sold anywhere.
If you've leveraged
the fund, now you've got debt service to meet. You've got to pay your interest due on the money you borrowed, which very quickly turns it into a Ponzi scheme. In other words, you've got to sell the remaining good assets to pay off the mortgage service on the bad assets. And if people want out of it in any way, you're the first ones who want to get their money, but if you wait very long, you're not getting anything. And that's how it started to melt down.
The last one in the chain winds up holding the bag.
It's like hot potato.
Or maybe the second one in the chain ends up holding the bag, depending upon how bad the failures are. So institutions like, you know, Bear Stearns started out months ago. They said they had just these two funds that went bad, and they tried to prop it up with $6 billion of capital. And, you know, that was a bad sign. Of course, Bear Stearns now is completely bankrupt, virtually worthless, maybe actually having tremendous liabilities yet to be realized. And, you know, we're seeing many of these institutions, if they had to mark their assets to market today, you'd probably have a whole raft of similar breakdowns and bankruptcies.
Now, mark to market.
Banks don't have enough.
I'm sorry.
Mark to market means you take a security that you own and you say, how much is this really worth today?
Okay.
Mark to market is like you own a stock portfolio. And you don't want to value it at what you bought it at, but you want to value it at what those securities are currently worth in the market. So you mark their current price to market. And if you do that with your investment portfolio, you know, you may have bought, you know, $20 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities, but they might right now be worth $2 billion if anybody would buy them.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's why I say it's a crisis in assets. That's not a crisis in liquidity. In other words, see, typically when things slow down, it's because interest rates have tightened or people can't get, there's not enough money in the system. People aren't making loans. Today, people aren't making loans because they are so afraid of this, all these markets, they don't want any more mortgage-backed securities or commercial loans. But the truth is there's plenty of money out there. You know, the Fed has probably dumped close to $1 trillion into various loan facilities, that any banks who want this, and now any securities firms who want it, come and take it. And what the Fed is doing is they're saying, you know, park your worthless mortgage-backed securities here, and we'll give you good money for them. But see, the Fed can only loan for a day or up to 28 days on any of these facilities, and then you got to buy your worthless securities back. You can't permanently use the loan funds to operate on. And that's where the rub is. You know, you can use borrowed money for your asset calculations, but unfortunately, you've got to give the borrowed money back.
So what happens if a company that does this with the Fed, after 28 days, day 29, they can't, you know, do anything?
Well, if day 29 they can't do it, the Fed sells their assets.
Okay. It's like a pawn shop.
Like a pawn shop. They go to the pawn shop, but what they're bringing to the pawn shop is worthless. The pawn shop, you bring something good, they don't give you very much money for it. Here at the Fed, they're bringing these junk assets, and the Fed's saying, we'll give you what you paid for them, even though we know they're worthless.
That's insane.
Well, it's the way it keeps the system going. See, if they didn't do this, then the banks wouldn't be able to continue this illusion like they still have assets. They have the cash, and the Fed gave them good cash for those lousy assets, but they're taking the lousy assets back, and they're giving back the good cash within 28 days.
Which seems unlikely. I mean, I'm not an expert in high finance, but what are the odds that these worthless assets are going to be?
Well, if they can get $28 million, if they get whatever $1 million they need to do to buy them back, or they just kind of roll the loan over. I mean, there's lots of games the Fed can then play. But, you know, conceivably, if the Fed calls in these loans, the whole house of cards can come down. That's why I call it a meltdown. And even with the Fed giving them good money, I mean, they can't use that money to make their debt service for very long, because the Fed's going to be saying, okay, well, now I'm calling back my securities. Well, you gave out that money to the debt service, and what you leveraged your fund with, gone, and the Fed sold your securities. And you've got another, you know, margin call coming up in 15 days when your next mortgage payment or your next payment is due and the money you borrowed to go into the market. See, the entire financial system right now is highly leveraged. These banks and securities firms and funds that were based in these assets, to improve their yields, they borrowed money and made similar bets. So they leveraged up. You know, with the borrowing, they figured they could get so many earnings as these assets appreciated that they could increase their yield on the assets they hold and pay the debt service off, and they would all win. That's the kind of calculation you can make if the market's only going up. And for a while, it looked like these markets would only go up. At the, you know, at the height of the mortgage bubble, it looked like my home's now worth $2 million. Well, I'll just wait, it'll be worth $3 million, and I'll build an addition on it, it'll be worth $4 million. Well, you know, people who were thinking their homes were worth $1 million are sitting in $500,000 homes with maybe $800,000 mortgages.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are quite a few people finding themselves upside down in their houses right now.
Well, and if watch the news, what they're telling us is, oh, it's the subprime market, and it's those subprime loans that are starting to really affect the prime market. And boy, it's all the fault of those people who are doing these 125% loans. Well, I think that is part of it, but it sounds to me like it's a big scheme.
Well, the whole thing was a inflated market. And with the Fed throwing so much money in 2003 and 2004, I knew in 2003 and 2004 this was going to happen. I mean, for instance, I said, okay, with the properties that we own, when I saw rates down at 1%, I refinanced everything immediately, and then paid it all down, as much as I could pay it down, and sold things to pay it down.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I went to get fixed-rate 15-year mortgages, which were the lowest rates I thought I could ever get them, and then aimed to pay them off in 2 years.
And well, that's the really smart way to do it. That is the smart way to use the system.
Well,
but
because
sadly, a lot of people couldn't do that.
I knew what was coming was that, A, I wouldn't be able to get a loan like this again. because rates were going to go up, and they did. They went up to 5.5%, and that you know, as the market slowed down, which it had to, it was going to crash. It was a bubble. Bubbles always burst. It's the same thing they did in the dot-coms. They pumped that up mm-hmm. to values and that were inevitable to burst. There's a couple of other markets yet to burst. The hedge funds, which are these little understood funds, which are now probably about $6 trillion in value, maybe more, also started out with a little bit of capital, and they borrowed, and then they bought more investments. Many of the hedge funds, for instance, got $1 billion from insurance companies or pension funds or whatever to manage, and they went and borrowed $25 billion against the $1 billion they had, and they invested all $26 billion in the stock market. Well, of course, when the stock market was going to 14,400, and it looked like it might go to 16,000, you know, they were all making a lot of money. When the stock market's at 12,000, with the possibility that it's been going under 12,000, maybe it'll head towards 10,000, well, then suddenly the hedge funds are in the same situation I described with the banks. Suddenly they've got to pay the debt service on that $25 billion they borrowed, but they don't have as many good assets as they thought because the value of their portfolio has gone down in a declining stock market. So now they've got to sell the best stocks in order to meet the debt service. And as the stock market continues to go down, they don't have enough stocks to sell even to meet their debt service. And it's a Ponzi scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those investors, realizing it's coming out, say, you know, pension funds say, give me my $1 billion back. Well, you can't do that very much to the real investors you've got because you're trying to keep their money in as a last resort to use it to meet your debt service and hope the stocks start going back up in value. At some point, it crashes.
You wrote an article at WorldNet Daily earlier this week, Jerry, about the EU now taking over in the number one ranking in terms of the world's largest economy. The United
Correct.
States is now no longer the world's number one economy.
Correct.
And a lot of criticism is being is being directed at this president or the former president, or there's a lot of blame that's being laid out there. I just have to step back and look at the policies of the Fed over the last the last two terms, Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan, and the amount of money that they pumped into the system through cheap credit. You say you saw this coming in 2003. Did they really not see this? Are they really that stupid? Or was there another plan at work here?
Well, it's what I argued in the late, great USA, that the only way you could really make sense of what they were doing, and, you could say, well, Greenspan didn't know what he was doing. Well, I don't agree with that. I think that the what made sense here was that the plan was to create a North American economy. And to do that, they knew that they had to tank the dollar. And the plan was to plug into a global economy where they would send the jobs overseas. China, they're going to go use slave labor, and the multinational corporations are pushing this agenda. So these bubbles bursting, creating an economic crisis and the dollar crashing, the solution we're going to be offered here very soon is, look how strong, how wonderfully Europe is doing. Europe's got this big, robust economy. They've surpassed us. And the euro is now competing to be maybe the number one currency in the foreign exchange market. So we've got to copy Europe. We'll have to go to a North American Union and an Amero. And that's going to be the out of this crisis that we're going into. You're going to hear increasingly these kinds of thoughts being offered as a solution. And I've argued it was engineered that way from the beginning.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that I think 5 years ago, if we had broached this subject, well, you were being accused of being a foil hat wearing conspiracy theorist for bringing this up even a year ago.
Right.
But we had a business lunch yesterday, and I was talking with a fellow who does business across the border into Canada, and the Canadians now are feeling the pinch because the loonie is too valuable.
Exactly.
They don't get that nice exchange rate anymore.
And they want a common currency between Canada and the United States.
And,
or they
and,
want the Canadian dollar pegged to the U.S. dollar.
Yes.
Exactly right, which is in effect creating a continental currency.
A continental currency. It's first step. The two countries combine to create a currency, and then Mexico comes along.
Right. And interestingly, the businessmen that we were eating with yesterday and discussing, you know, the economy were very open to the idea, think, you know, hey, that maybe that is a good idea. Protect us against
right.
these fluctuations in the currency,
well, see,
the exchange rate.
As soon as the reality changes, and, you know, this is how it was done in Europe, the fait accomplis were created, and then the people came along with their thinking. As soon as you create a new economic reality, in other words, in Canada, the loonie is so expensive that, you know, the billionaires who invested in these companies or the people who are managing them are saying, wait a minute, my exports are hurt. They say, well, my exports would not be hurt if we had a common currency. So I don't want the currency risk in North America. Many of my exports are going to the United States. As soon as I saw that the percentage of exports from a lot of Canadian companies were reaching 70% to the United States, I figured it, that we would have pleas to get a common currency very quickly. All it would take would be for the Canadian loonie to increase in value. And then as soon as it did, you know, what I saw was going to happen started happening. It's inevitable because those investors, again, they've got their money tied up in these corporations that are exporting to the United States. The last thing they want is to have their businesses damaged by currency risk, which was, you know, the weakening of the U.S. dollar, so their exports are more expensive.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's right. No, it's the same. I finished that thought.
Well, I was just going to say that because the dollar really isn't backed by anything, unless you want to say it's backed by oil, it's just sort of whatever people will pay for it. But I could even say it's not even backed by oil anymore. More and more
the dollar's not backed by anything.
More and more. Well, you know, there are those who say, well, that petrodollar, it's, you know, because they trade in dollars.
No,
not anymore. More and more bourses are saying no dollars.
It's not backed by anything. The dollar is a fiat currency, 100% fiat currency. And the value of the dollar, like any commodity, fluctuates based upon demand and supply.
Mm-hmm.
So as we're doing right now, where we're producing, we're generating so many dollars that's thrown into the system, that's a major pressure to devalue the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth less because there's so many available. You know, it doesn't mean you have more.
Exactly. It's what I have is less worth less.
What you have is worth less.
Yeah.
Well, and there are those who would argue then that, well, China is bracing the dollar, so to speak. But you know what? Our relationship with China is starting to go downhill big time.
Well, the relationship with China, both the Clinton and the Bush administration, there was a lot of discussion that if we would only trade with China, it would be to, you know, China would have an economic interest in remaining our friends, and it would reduce the likelihood of a war. Well, I always thought that argument was ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Because, okay, let's say China's got now 1.4 or 1. Whatever trillion dollars in U.S. In foreign exchange reserves, 70 or 80% of which is held in dollars. Okay, so you say, well, China doesn't want to do anything that would be harmful because if the dollar were hurt, you know, those holdings would be worth less. But let's take an extreme analysis. Let's say that China could destroy the United States, even if it meant losing $1.4 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. That's a good deal. I mean, how much have we spent on the Iraq war?
Precisely. That's, frankly, it's a pretty cheap way to take down such a huge nation.
If you take down a country for only $1 trillion, a country like the United States of America, you know, what a bargain. And the Chinese might just calculate to do that. So, you know, the idea that and then you say, okay, what are they using our foreign exchange reserves for? Well, things that they were using it for were to build a military.
Mm-hmm.
They built one of the biggest militaries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And using all of our technical knowledge, because when we sent them these goods to produce, if the goods were electronic or technically advanced,
mm-hmm.
to produce them, they learned all the technical secrets.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah.
Thank you, Al.
Mm-hmm.
So we just shipped them all of our patents and technical knowledge which they can reverse engineer into and derive now as their own and copy. And they can use that knowledge to build their own militaries, which they did, with our money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that military is, you know, creating submarines that tracks the Kitty Hawk, building missiles that destroy satellites in space, and creating an army that's able to go and repress Tibet and who knows what else, or China, anybody who disagrees with them, demonstrating once again that they are not capitalists in our sense. They're
communists who learn to make money. They had the submarine that came up off the coast of California a couple of years ago, run silent.
We didn't even know they were there. Now, if the Kitty Hawk didn't know that submarine was there, what kind of electronic systems does that submarine have to hide itself from the Kitty Hawk's advanced measures and security systems?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Supposed to detect another submarine in the area.
Mm-hmm. And while we're on the subject of the national security impact of our economic crisis, let's talk about an article that you wrote earlier this week for WorldNet Daily about the U.S. Treasury getting a little nervous about Islamic investment in American financial institutions. One of the big stories of the last 3 months or so was the investment by sovereign wealth funds from the Middle East investing in American financial giants like Citi and Bank of America to prop them up, and Merrill Lynch. What happens if, and Jerry, you know, as the author of Atomic Iran, you've, you know, done some research into this area. What happens if we should get into a conflict with a Middle Eastern state and suddenly these oil sheikhs say, you know what, we think we'd like our money back now, Citigroup. We'd like our money back, Merrill Lynch. What happens then?
Well, we've made ourselves totally vulnerable. And I see, I think, again, part of the plan was that we would, you know, as we needed new capital, the globalists like the idea that we would have the capital return as investments to our banks and our other institutions, and even then sell infrastructure, because they'd see then, again, the tightening of relations, you know, like the Chinese, if they're working with us, if their money's here, they have to work with us. And besides that, it was kind of like this great scam. We got the oil and made them invest in us. But the problem is, you know, I'm quite confident that as our banks begin to need capital, which they do, as I said, this is an asset crisis. Not going to be, Bernanke could put the rates to zero tomorrow, and he could put $25 trillion on the table for the banks to borrow, and this crisis wouldn't be stopped for a half an hour, maybe a day or two. Wall Street would probably throw a party, think everything's going to be fine. But after they sobered up and realized what was going on, the crisis would, you know, just kick back into gear because the next institution would fail. And more capital coming in is needed. Where are you going to get it? Well, the only place you look around the world where there's capital is, the petrodollars, because we've been buying oil at $100 a barrel instead of developing our own or trying to increase supplies to reduce the cost, which we could do, build more refineries, take tax breaks away from the oil companies unless they develop more of their reserves and put it into the system. There's lots of ways to get more supply. But what we're doing is we're saying, okay, we'll take the petrodollars back, we'll take the Chinese dollars back. And the article I wrote this week was mostly to let people be aware that the Treasury's already got this plan. They've been meeting for months with these sovereign wealth funds, and they've been talking to the Chinese, you know, the Middle East and the Chinese, to try to determine the conditions under which, you know, we're going to be able to go through the CFIUS, this Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, and the Treasury, and be able to approve these investments without it being a crisis. Now, first of all, the investments will occur when there is a crisis. In other words, the next Bear Stearns that goes, people say, well, it didn't go because the Chinese saved it. You know, the Chinese, of course, the Arabs now are also going to own 20% of NASDAQ, our second largest trading market. And along with it's going to come Sharia law, because they're going to say there's certain things these companies are doing or certain things that you're doing that we don't like. And since and as you pointed out, okay, so now we get into a war, or we decide to put economic pressure on Iran. We're trying to do, And, you know, our banks, we start, you know, the president starts getting calls from Citibank and saying, my board doesn't like your policy towards Iran. You know, they're going to take their money out, or they're going to sell the investment to somebody else, or they're going to do any number of different things, because if they're owning the bank, the sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East or the Chinese, they're empowered now to set policy for that corporation. Who's going to stop them? You pull out a piece of paper that says, you promised you wouldn't do this. Well, we own the shares.
Well, Jerry, the funny thing about this is it used to be treasonous to, you know, be indebted to a foreign nation, especially one that we were likely to go to war with.
Well, and, you know, the yes, you're right. But there was a time when made in America meant something. We're dealing with a multinational corporate agenda here that wants to create an international corporate state. And they're beyond borders. They're beyond the United States. I mean, you know, David Rockefeller, when you hear him talk about his desires to create, a new world order, mm-hmm. which he's open about in his memoirs, or George Soros, when he writes, like, you know, the age of fallibility, and he says that nation states belong to the days when kings had castles. I don't think either Rockefeller or Soros would mind that the United States went away. It might just serve you and me. It's not going to bother them.
Well,
they're already post-nation state. They're post-national. They're post-United States.
It seems to me
was a nice little historical accident that was created by a group of men in Philadelphia who wore wigs and wrote with quill pens.
Well,
I don't think it applies to them.
Is it? Boy, the Constitution, a living document.
Once you internalize that perspective, uh-huh. you realize that, you know, they've redefined everything to be international.
Right.
Well, Jerry, as we going through the interview here, we're apparently hitting some heavy net traffic, and it's making it difficult to get the balance of the interview out. But basically want to sum up, where do you see this going? I mean, you see a deliberate attempt to break down the economy of the United States, break down the borders of the United States. Where does this all lead in your view?
Well, it's why I wrote the late great USA. I think we're headed first into a North American Union, and it's all going to get plugged into world trade. I think we'll be merged together with Europe in a transatlantic union, and from there it's anybody's guess, but it's world government unfolding at a very rapid pace.
Dr. Jerome Corsi is the author, of course, of The Late Great USA and other books like Black Gold Stranglehold, The Myth of Scarcity and the Politics of Oil, Atomic Iran, and a number of other books, and we thank him for being with us today.
Oh, absolutely.
The reason you don't hear his voice from this point on in the program is because we ran into some bizarre technical issues.
It was the strangest thing. We called him back, what, four times?
Yes.
And at about 33 minutes in, it just
That's right.
died.
I hadn't even noticed that part of it.
It was about
right.
33 seconds. It was so funny. It just died entirely, and we just had to say, that's it. And we called him back on the cell phone to say goodbye to him because we do our interviews via Skype,
mm-hmm.
and that makes a nice, clean interview. It's great for us, but we're not
and
really
very cost
sure.
effective.
Oh,
yeah.
Very cost effective, and we don't know if it's because it's in the afternoon, well, late evening that we're doing this, rather that perhaps there are a lot of kids in the area who are downloading movies or this and that, or I don't know. You could put on a tinfoil hat and say
heavy
some
web
things,
traffic,
but. So, but anyway, we had to bid him farewell. We were going to have him for the entire hour. And now you get to listen to us blather on and on and on.
Which is okay, because there's plenty to blather about out there. You know, the thing I was really surprised about, and this is a story that he wrote, we referred to in the interview, and you linked at peeringintodarkness.com, that the United States is now no longer the world's number one economy. That position has been surpassed by the European Union. And I was startled to read that.
You know, it almost makes when I read that, I thought, huh, this must be how England felt when the United States bumped them off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we may never be number one again.
That's possible. The United States gross domestic product for 2007 estimated at $13.8 billion. The GDP for the EU countries, 15 of them, estimated at 8.85 billion euros. But because of the exchange rate between the euro and the dollar now, that is worth more than the American economy.
So I have a question. Is the bookkeeping system for figuring out GDP, et cetera, the same in Europe as it is here. Because we have fuzzy mathematics here in the United States, and I don't know if they have fuzzy math over there. I know they're metric in many of those towns. Mm-hmm. But I'm just – seriously, I wonder if worldwide if there is a standard – we're figuring those things out, or if it's just I'm going to fudge these numbers to make us look the best we can. We may not even be number two is what I'm saying. We may be way down the list.
Yeah, well, at least it feels like number two this week.
Yeah,
well,
it sure does.
I don't know how that's all calculated, but we'll put a link to the article by Jerry Corsi, and you can read it for yourself. He published it earlier this week. Again, kind of startling news, mm-hmm. and a bit upsetting for those of us who still are very patriotic. And for all the criticism that we level against this government and this nation during the course of PID radio, we are both very patriotic. We believe
Absolutely.
In the ideals for which we were raised to think that the flag represented.
Mm-hmm. That's the difference, because the country the United States of America is ceasing to be. The one that I grew up believing in and pledging allegiance to is disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm so angry. Now, as a Christian, I look at that and I think, okay, I can't invest so much anger in that it's destructive to my witness, because our sovereignty has to be first and foremost to the Lord. But he also, you know, has allowed the situation of governments on the earth. And we could get into that whole divine council, mm-hmm. and then who is really in charge of our government, but that's for another discussion. But ultimately, you know, I was raised, you know, red, white, and blue. You mm-hmm. pledge to yep. the flag. You sing the songs. I love it. I get misty-eyed and the whole thing. We put the flags out in the summertime. But I'm starting to think, does that stand for anything anymore?
Yeah. Or is it a way to manipulate those of us who have a deep felt love for the country into supporting the policies engineered by the ruling elites.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these policies.
And that'll really get you mad.
It will. When you start thinking about the way you've been abused, I mean, it's like being betrayed by a significant other. Mm-hmm. It's really painful. And this is why we've had Jerry Corsi on the last, twice now in the last 6 weeks, because he sees, as we do, the evidence pointing to a deliberate sellout of this nation's sovereignty and its ideals in the interest of power and profit.
Mm-hmm.
The global economy is driving investors to break down national borders because they're getting in the way. But not just investors, manufacturers who are in need of cheap labor. They want to see labor move across national borders without any impediment. And the border crossings from Mexico into the United States are keeping cheap labor south of the border, or at least slowing it down a little bit for the time being. And the same will hold true with the Canadian border, actually. One of the things that came out in the conversation I referred to yesterday about the economy in Canada, this business lunch, was the shortage of labor in Canada's oil fields. Canada would love to exploit their oil sands areas up around Fort McMurray more than they're able to. But they just can't find enough people to go up there and work.
You know, it's one thing to sit here in our comfy house and say, well, why don't they do more oil drilling in this place or that? Do you ever watch Ice Truckers?
Yeah.
Derek and I watch Ice Truckers. And I got to tell you, those guys earn every penny they make and more.
Yeah.
They should get paid far more than they do.
Yeah. Now, I don't know that Fort McMurray is quite as remote
as the places in the diamond mines up there.
But
well, exactly.
It is pretty far north.
Some of those oil fields, when you were selling back in Missouri,
that's true.
There were times that they would say to you, we need this the steel up here now, this pipe up here now, because
yes.
we have to truck it before the road melts.
Exactly. The North Slope of Alaska up there, the Prudhoe Bay and that North Slope, the Alaska Wildlife National Wildlife Refuge, is on the north coast of Alaska. The only way to get there is through the ice road. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, we sold a couple of truckloads of pipe once that needed to be delivered to Juneau or Fairbanks or wherever it was so that they could get them out of trucks by the end of March, because once you get into April, some of those ice roads begin to melt and get very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, because the mill was late, they couldn't wait for the pipe to be shipped via cargo vessel up to Alaska. And I think, as I recall, they spent the money to have the pipe literally airlifted by helicopter.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a left turn, because when we were talking to Jerry Corsi, one of the things that we were sort of touched on toward the end there before we started breaking up so badly was the situation with China and how China owns over $1 trillion of worth of U.S. dollars. I don't know how you
treasury
securities. Thank you very much. There's a story that I put up today at as a top story at peeringintodarkness.com, PID News, about the number of ships that we have in and around Taiwan right now. This weekend, Taiwan has their election. Included with it now, bear in mind, Taiwan is technically, as far as the Chinese are concerned, a province of China.
Yeah, a rogue province. It would be like Texas declaring its sovereignty.
Exactly. But Taiwan has been for many years now making noises about wanting to be just as independent as Kosovo is now. And back in 2001, April, March and April of 2001, President Bush pledged to do whatever it took to help out Taiwan. Anytime they needed the United States would be there. And that meant if the Taiwan people wanted to declare independence and China interfered militarily, he said that we would be there. Well, they have an election coming up. There's a referendum in there, not for independence, but it's sort of a tangential way of getting at it and declaring it. They're asking to be part of the UN under the name Just Taiwan.
Instead
not
of,
Taiwan, you know, province of China or whatever their full title is.
Yeah, Republic
just
of
Taiwan.
China. Or,
exactly. That by doing that, China, if they vote yes on it, I can guarantee China is not going to take that kindly. They're in a snit right now with everything that's going on in the province of Tibet, which used to be a sovereign country.
Right.
And that is spreading beyond the Tibetan beyond Sichuan or whatever the name of the province is. It's spreading to others, and the military, the Chinese military, has been going in the last couple of days. They're sending more and more troops in. This is escalating way out of control, and China wants to clamp down on it because they have the Olympics coming up in July, and they want to look really spiffy for the world before that happens.
And they've got other issues as well with separatists in and my pronunciation is going to be horrible here, but I believe it's Guangdong province, which is the basically farthest western, the westernmost province in China, which is home of the ethnic group called the Uyghurs, U-I-G-H-U-R. Those are essentially Turks, and they've been agitating for the creation of a state called East Turkestan or East, you know, basically East Turkestan. Muslim, and there are separatist groups there. In fact, I read an article just a few weeks ago about an American who toured through this province and met many of the Uyghurs who are convinced that the United States is going to ride to the rescue. I don't know why or how, but that's a, you know, a subject for another story. And it's a topic that Dave Emery has covered in his podcast for the record on a number of occasions. But the United States, in advance of this election coming up this weekend in Taiwan, has positioned a couple of aircraft carriers off the east coast of Taiwan. Not, well, not off the east coast, but east of Taiwan in the Indian Ocean. In fact, the USS Kitty Hawk, the one that was surprised by the Chinese submarine.
Yes, I know. And when he talked about that, I thought, well, the Kitty Hawk's there now. I wonder if they'll get surprised again.
So that is going to be, yeah, that's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out.
Well, I remember, what was it, a year and a half ago when oh, gosh, what group was it that was over there? A ship that was, it was around Thanksgiving, and they were hit by a Japanese. They had some sort of trouble, and they wanted to port in a Chinese port, and China said no. This was at Thanksgiving. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact details.
Wasn't it a U.S. vessel that was going to put in for leave in Hong Kong?
Was
and
that
then
it?
And then the Chinese withdrew permission at the last minute?
It was something very strange. Very definitely strained relationships between the two countries, the United States and China, and they are getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, and remember, again, China holds an awful lot of United States debt in the form of U.S. Treasury securities, an awful lot of currency, United States currency, that could be dumped onto the world market to further devalue the dollar.
Do you know, we haven't heard from our buddy up in North Korea for a while. Where is he?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. What is North Korea doing?
Kim Jong-il, where are you?
It's a boring world when he's not
Usually by now he's not been in the news, and I tell you what, I look all kinds of places for stories. Generally, when it goes this long, he jumps up and says, "Notice me."
Mm-hmm.
So why is he so quiet? Because we have that story out of Syria that the Israelis bombed the nuclear, what they said was a nuclear facility
in northern Syria.
In northern
right?
Syria, mm-hmm. that was being built and co-opted by North Korea, by Kim Jong-il.
Right.
Is he being quiet because he doesn't want to be noticed right now?
That's possible. That's possible. Yeah, there are a lot of interesting things happening around the world. Not that you'd know it from the major media focusing on what Obama's pastor said. We won't even go there. That's been beat to death. But we will just remind you that when something like that dominates the news, you really need to start looking elsewhere for the important things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we brought Jerry Corsi on, just as a reminder. These things that are happening in the economic realm are not the product of an accident. And it's not the fault of people, a whole bunch of people who went out and got mortgages that they couldn't afford because they were greedy.
That's how it's being spun.
And to some extent, that's part of it. You know, people should have been wiser about the money. But it's hard mm-hmm. to resist when you're hitting that, when you're getting that propaganda through the television every single night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is how you live the good life. You cash in. Don't leave your money just sitting there doing nothing in your house. Cash in. And
well, you know, you could also blame the rabbit for, you know, falling into that trap and losing his leg.
Yeah.
Your fault. You should have known.
Yeah. So that, but as Jerry points out, the salient point, which is one that no one in the major media is going to discuss, is that when you ask, how did this happen? You either have to believe that Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and his predecessor, Alan Greenspan, were too stupid to know that keeping interest rates unnaturally low and pumping a lot of money into the world economy was going to result in a bubble that would have to break at some point, mm-hmm. pop. Or you have to consider the possibility that they were doing this on purpose and that this is what they wanted all along. Where you get average working people, like the guys I was having lunch with yesterday, saying, you know what, maybe giving up the U.S. dollar for a regional currency is a good idea.
And you have stories like, a few weeks ago, we had a story out of New York. They're now accepting euros at some places in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So watch for that as we go forward. There is a story that you posted, Peering into Darkness, the other day that I think needs to be discussed, because I think this is really, it's almost science fiction-like in its implications, and yet it's happening. The United Kingdom, once again taking the lead in creating the total surveillance state, is considering putting young children onto a national DNA list if they show signs of becoming future criminals.
Isn't that awful?
Think about that. Little six-year-old Johnny is just bad, and we know he's going to grow up to be some kind of murderer
someday. He's been disturbing our class every day. He raises that hand every time he doesn't understand a math problem.
Yeah.
We don't trust him.
And this is coming from the Director of Forensic Sciences for Scotland Yard and the new DNA spokesman for the Association of Chief Police Officers. So these aren't mm-hmm. guys coming from the fringes of society. These are guys who are in among the elite of the crime fighting units in the United Kingdom, among the best in the world. And they're recommending that they take children who appear to be at risk for becoming future criminals and compiling a DNA database of these kids. Now, think about how far that can go. For one thing, it's going to stigmatize the kids.
Absolutely.
We need to take a cheek swab from you, little Tommy, because we know that you're going to grow up to be a serial rapist. Or at least you show.
Oh, I am?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But secondly, what are you going to do when you start collecting this data? What do scientists offer? Well, you start collecting data, you start analyzing the data to mm-hmm. see what kind of patterns you can discern. And this is in your realm where you've got some.
Absolutely.
Some
I think that's what they're going to do. They're going to take a look and see if there is a pattern, as you say. Okay, we've taken a look at 200 cheek swabs, and we've noticed that chromosome 12 or whatever, let's say, that gene, you know, XYZ, you know, 1, 2, 3 on this chromosome is mutated in 30 of them. Boy, that must be a crime gene.
Mm-hmm. which then leads to babies being tested and their DNA being examined as soon as they're born. Congratulations, mm-hmm. Mrs. Gordon. You've just delivered an 8-pound, 4-ounce future murderer.
Exactly. Now, we're simplifying things, but anytime you start prosecuting a crime and labeling kids before anything has happened, that's thought crime. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That's playing the futures game with our children's welfare.
Yep. And it's that movie Minority Report, the Tom Cruise film.
Oh, absolutely. And what do you want to bet? That there won't be very many children from the upper crust, so to speak, society. Well, we've noticed that it's mainly these socioeconomic lower rung kids that are, you know, well, that's understandable because they're just rowdy anyway.
Strong correlation between economic status and tendency to be involved in crime. So we need to just swab all these kids below a certain income level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it may or may not go that direction. But again, the implications of something like this are really frightening. The sad thing is that according to, you know, survey after survey of Americans over the last few years, it appears that most of us just don't care. Big Brother is here. And despite the fact that there seem to be new revelations coming out every couple of months that the National Security Agency is, in fact, sifting through phone calls of Americans talking to other Americans without the benefit of a warrant. The fact that other intelligence organizations and groups within the government are sifting through records of purchases and reading habits and examining library records and things like that. Most Americans appear not to care.
Yeah.
Civil libertarians are pulling their hair out because they don't know what to do. I mean, there are so many amendments, violations of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The one that says the government can only search through your stuff if they present a warrant signed by a judge.
Yeah, that Constitution, that's a living document. That, yeah.
Written by guys wearing wigs and writing with quill pens.
I love that. I love that.
So sadly, we are witnessing the dissolution of the America that we knew.
Yeah.
Because most Americans just don't give a rip. They want to be left alone to watch Survivor on TV without having to worry about, mm-hmm. you know, these bigger issues. And, you know, okay, if the government's going to look in through my windows, even though, you know, hey, if you're not doing anything, you don't have anything to hide, right?
Well, you know, I've used this analogy before, but so forgive me, bear with me. But back in Nebraska, we had a storage silo for grain silo for the corn. And we would dry it out. And as corn dries out, it settles. It settles in shipment. But this had a crust on top. There was one year where there was a crust on the top. And when this happens, if you look at it from above in this big silo, it looks like it's full of corn. Mm-hmm. But you can. There are doors on the ground level where you can access the corn. You can go in and you can actually remove corn. But also, again, there's settling that takes place. Well, if you walk on that crust, which actually did happen when I was out there, there was a farmhand who walked on the crust, and it wasn't until afterward he got down and looked inside the silo to access another part of it. He almost had an industrial accident in his pants.
Yeah.
Because he realized that the corn had settled down, and there was probably 10 to 20 feet between the crust and the actual corn itself.
Yeah.
You don't want to fall into a grain silo full of corn. You just almost always die.
Think of
and
the
that's
movie.
What would have happened.
Yeah.
Had he walked on that crust and it just fallen through.
Mm-hmm. Think of the movie Witness when Harrison Ford came up with a very inventive way to dispatch a couple of his tormentors.
Yeah.
Inside a grain silo full of
corn. He thought he was walking on a solid surface.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not how, but you look at the United States now,
mm-hmm.
it's like looking at that grain silo from the top. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's nice and full. Great. We're just as well off as we ever have been. Boy, what a wonderful country. When in fact, it's not really there. It's just a shell.
Yep.
And underneath, it is totally different. And if you walk too long, you'll fall in and you'll wish you'd never done it.
Yep.
And I think a lot of people are going to get trapped into that. Now, what are we saying? What is the bottom line here? Mm-hmm. Are we saying, run and panic? You know, move out into the country and you know, stock up on guns? No, we're not saying that. If you want to have a gun, that's fine. We're not saying that.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying, and I'm not going to speak for you, this is what I'm saying. I'm saying rejoice when you see these things, because this is the way the world is supposed to play out in prophecy.
Yep.
If you look at the Bible, prophecy tells us it's not going to get better and better. It's going to get worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And as it gets worse and worse, you know, praise the Lord for it. Ask for guidance for it. Prepare. Do put some food aside. Know that it's coming, because he told us it's coming for a reason. And when you have that extra food, share it, and share the gospel as you do it.
Exactly.
Because that's why we're here.
It's to be salt and light to the world around us.
Yeah. You know,
in the world, but not
be a Joseph to your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we talk about these things, just so that we're prepared and not destroyed for lack of knowledge, as the prophet Hosea quoted.
Yeah,
God,
well, you give it time. It's going to be Jose.
Yeah, well, you know, that's how it translates into the Spanish.
I know.
So, again, thank you to Jerry Corsi for his time today, especially in getting through a difficult interview with the technical problems. Next week, we hope to have those resolved and not run into any issues as we talk with the one and only Visigoth.
You can't beat that. My gosh, what a week that's going to be.
Yeah. Like Michael Corbin has been very influential on us. And boy, just really a rock out there. A guy like Michael Corbin who goes out there and produces these interviews and these shows and writes and researches and doesn't do it to try to make a living off of it.
I know, and what a mind. And he makes connections all over the place. I can't wait to talk to him.
And a big baseball fan, so you got to love that, too.
You got to love that, that's for sure.
Meanwhile, you're welcome to discuss these topics that we raise here on this program or to bring things to our attention, either by sending us email, which is derek@peeringintodarkness.com.
Or you can send one to me, sharon@peeringintodarkness.com. And we will put a link in the show notes. And also there is a graphic link in the sidebars of all of our sites to the Michael Corbin memorial site. And we'd love for you to stop by. And the site's going to grow over the next few days. It just went up today. But if you want to leave a comment, you know, just if you've been touched in any way by his work, you know, just say a note.
Yeah. And until next time, have a blessed Resurrection Sunday. And I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
Forget about the former days and living in the past. God can do a new thing now in a kingdom that will last. He'll make a way across your wilderness like a river.
news and analysis on demand.
This is PID Radio.